Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let me take you on a journey to the coldest place on Earth and its last and greatest wilderness, on a voyage to Antarctica. Hello and welcome to A Voyage to Antarctica, brought to you by the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. I'm your host, Alok Jha. What do Antarctic seals and grime music have in common? This week I'll be finding out from Prem Gill, a polar conservationist and polar explorer, who's crazy about all things wildlife, sea ice and nature. Prem is a PhD candidate leading the Seals from Space project with the Scott Polar Research Institute, British Antarctic Survey and World Wildlife Fund. He's also a researcher working on the BBC programme Frozen Planet. Beyond that, Prem is interested in increasing opportunities for underrepresented and disadvantaged groups in polar and conservation science. As the founder of Polar Impact and the British Antarctic Survey's diversity champion, he's used his research to spearhead projects which attract and retain talent from non-traditional backgrounds. He's hosted week-long citizen science and hackathon events. He's also used the sounds of Antarctic seals to produce, you guessed it, grime music. What kinds of seals are there and how are they different? I mean, the amount that I know about seals beyond their general amazingness in terms of what they look like and everything is that I know that Weddell seals, for example, are the ones that everyone thinks of as cute and amazing and lovely to look at. And, you know, they're these perfect sort of cylindrical round things, essentially. And then there's the leopard seals, which are something else entirely in terms of slightly more sinister creatures. And that's what we hear anyway. Tell us the sort of the main types of seal and which one's your kind of personal favorite.
Okay, yes. So you've mentioned, I guess, the two big players that everyone knows, the very, very adorable Weddell seal and the slightly scary but cool leopard seal.
But they are scary, but a little bit, aren't they? I'm not just trying to anthropomorphize here, but they are slightly scary.
I think it's the lack of visible neck on a leopard seal. It's just shoulders and muscles and head and teeth, and it does have a slightly serpentine look to it, and it does have a bit of a grin going on, which at certain angles is cute, and at other angles not so great, a bit creepy, I would say. But for me personally, I love all the seals, of course, and I guess within the groups you've mentioned, there's six species of seals in Antarctica. So you have your fur seals and your elephant seals, which really drove the early exploration of Antarctica because they were being hunted for their fur for markets in, you know, China, New York, London. You also had elephant seals being hunted for their oil. But outside of that, you have the ice seals. Now, they weren't really hunted extensively. There was no sort of commercial sealing industry based on the ice seals. But they are, you know, amongst the most numerous seals globally. So you have the crab eater seal. There's the Ross seal, which is very small, very rare. I think there's only about 70,000, an estimated population of 70,000 for the Ross seal. So they are the most, well, actually, no, leopard seals, there's only 30,000. So you have your Ross and your leopard seals, which are both relatively rare. They're quite solitary. And we really don't know much about the Ross at all. I mean, I myself, I just know what it looks like, and that's about it. And then, yeah, you have the leopard seal, which is the biggest seal species to exist. It is big, it's muscly, it's bulky. It's actually more like a... it's more like a fur seal in its sort of build than it is a Weddell seal. So just to say, there's a distinction between fur seals and sea lions and what you call true seals, the ones without ears, which are the crab eaters, the Weddells, the Ross and the leopards. But yeah, the leopards are a bit more built like a fur seal. And for those who have been to Antarctica, we all know the fur seals are... oh, I don't know what's the word. They're quite athletic creatures compared to a chubby little Weddell seal, and they can chase a person down a beach and run as fast as a human down a beach. And yeah, they have quite a bad bite from what I hear.
They can chase a person down the beach. That's not what I want to hear, if I'm honest. How did you get interested in those animals? I mean, of course, we all love seals because they're beautiful and cute, but what got you into them?
So my interest in seals began with witnessing the world's most rarest seal, which is the Mediterranean monk seal. And this was during my undergrad at Cardiff University studying marine geography. And we were in Greece doing fieldwork. And we had a report that, you know, monk seals were in the area. However, we were aware that these were really elusive and shy animals, and that typically it was extremely difficult to spot them because they would normally be hiding away in these secluded coastal caves. However, I did spot one, and it was on a sunbed surrounded by tourists.
Sunbed.
Yes, it was just lounging away on a sunbed, surrounded by tourists who were just having a great time eating kebabs and drinking beer.
Cocktail in its flipper.
Exactly. And I saw that scene and I thought to myself, well, wow, if this is how easy it is to monitor the world's most rarest seal, how easy would it be to monitor the most common seal? And it turns out that the seals were the highest abundances are the seals within Antarctica, and they're actually super, super, super difficult to monitor simply because they live in within that sea ice region, which is notoriously difficult to access and monitor.
And so, but go back even further. What got you interested in marine biology in the first place? Were you someone who was always every school holiday going off into the sea looking for creatures and things to look at? Were you constantly watching David Attenborough go around the oceans? What was it that got you into all of that?
Yeah, so you've just that's a good question, and you've just mentioned one of the reasons, which is definitely watching a lot of nature documentaries. But for me, it was a weird mix of playing a lot of Pokemon games. So as a kid, I didn't really engage in the countryside that much. My parents are from the Punjab, they're from India. And even though they themselves are from quite a rural region, I think a weird thing that typically happens with a lot of sort of immigrant kids is that in the UK, engaging with nature and doing recreation with nature suddenly, it's just quite a foreign concept. So it doesn't happen that much. But with me, I was a big fan of playing Pokemon. And that got me really interested into the concept of sort of, you know, finding, searching, researching wild animals. And at the
it
same
suddenly
time,
makes was, sense.
Yeah, yeah. And then at the same time, I was watching all these nature documentaries where I was aware that, hey, in England, there's owls, there's badgers, there's foxes, there's seals, there's all these amazing creatures, which to me were, you know, more or less Pokemon, because I didn't see them in real life. But I sort of knew they existed. And then I, yeah, that I suppose, the countryside and nature became this really interesting, exciting, almost mythical place because of that weird mix of really becoming intrigued by it but not actually getting to visit it. And that really made me quite interested in exploring and wishing to understand these regions and get a better, you know, just a better grasp of what's going on.
I suppose if you say that as a child, the communing with nature perhaps wasn't seen as something that you did just because that, you know, we do what our parents tell us to in many respects, don't we? And we see what they show us. And I suppose if you don't see it, then your journey into marine biology is, you know, as far away from that as possible, isn't it? So it's like it's you're thinking there is stuff out there, and I want to go and see it as far away as possible. And you've chosen the furthest place that you could possibly choose to sort of actually do your research, which is as ambitious as it gets. So it's quite impressive, all the way in Antarctica. So you're marine biology PhD, and then, you know, of course you're making documentaries now as well.
Yeah. It has gone full circle. I remember when I was in my first year of my undergrad watching the original Frozen Planet, and I remember even discussing some of the scenes that got me interested in orcas from Frozen Planet in my interview to go to Cambridge. To study my PhD in Antarctic studies, looking at seals from space. And now I'm working on Frozen Planet 2, 10 years later from the original. So it's really gone full circle. And I'm in a very, very, very privileged position to be able to do this during the pandemic and sort of put my research on pause and look at the polar world from another lens.
So you can't get away with calling a project Seals from Space and making it sound very sci-fi without explaining what that means. Tell us what your project actually is.
Sure. So my project is the study of Antarctic seals using very high resolution satellite imagery. And essentially for this, I'm studying seals along the Antarctic Peninsula, one of the most rapidly warming regions of the world. And we're using satellite data that is so high res, it's 30 centimeters per pixel. That not only can we see seals, we can see baby seals. And if a seal has just given birth, when we take the images during the breeding season, you can even see blood on the sea ice from where the seal's given birth all the way from space in these satellite images. So this is essentially, yes, it's a super sophisticated way of counting seals. And it's a really cost-effective way, and it's a really safe way of counting seals, because prior to investigating the uses of satellite imagery to count seals and penguins and so on, all of the wildlife monitoring in Antarctica was done from planes and ships. And as you can imagine, this is something that costs quite a lot of money. It can be dangerous at times going into the pack ice regions. And as a result, you also have quite a large gap in between surveys. So there's a lot of spotty data because of this. And as a result, we don't really have robust population trend data or even robust population estimates for a lot of the Antarctic seals. So the hope is by using satellite imagery and investigating how accurate this technique is and really investigating all the different ways we can explore not just the seals and their habitat across the whole of Antarctica, you can begin to start getting an insight not just into the population trends, but also what drives their distribution and what's happening with their habitat.
Hello, I'm Camilla Nichols, CEO of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust, and I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. We work to preserve and protect Antarctica's unique heritage, from the historic huts of early pioneers to the amazing discoveries in climate science. And our mission is to inspire current and future generations to discover, value and protect this precious wilderness. The pandemic has had a significant impact on our work, and we need your generosity now more than ever. Find out how you can help save Antarctica, protect our planet, and even adopt a penguin at ukaht.org. or search for the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
In this series and the previous one, we've talked about the history of Antarctica in terms of how it was first, you know, imagined and sighted as by whalers, essentially, in the Southern Ocean. And commercial sealing was all sealing was. Well, let me say that again. It sounds like I'm talking about decorating now. let me say that again. But seal hunting. Commercial seal hunting was also part of that whole period in this sort of late 19th century and beyond, before Antarctica was explored by the people, you know, that are famous now, Scott and Amundsen and all of those people. I'm just curious about how we got to the point of protecting seals. I mean, all wildlife on Antarctica now is pretty much protected, seals especially. I'm just wondering, you know, what sort of happened between the sort of violent, vicious age of sealing and killing everything we could to now, you know, very carefully monitoring these beautiful animals from space?
Yeah. So you brought up a very, very, very interesting topic. And just to say, I could be completely wrong on this, but I think it was actually the hunting of seals, so sealing, like you said. I think that came before the whaling. So I could be completely mistaken, but the way I understand it is that early reports of these really large populations of seals on islands such as South Georgia from explorers like James Cook in the late 18th century, that's what drove the very earliest exploration of Antarctica. So James Weddell, for example, who has the Weddell Seal named after him and the Weddell Sea, he was one of those early seal hunters. And like you said, it was interesting in that on one hand, it was violent. People were killing seals, depleting them at incredible rates. I mean, upon South Georgia, the population of fur seals, for example, they were pretty much depleted within decades. And then on other islands with smaller populations, such as the South Shetlands, it only took 3 seasons, so essentially 3 years, for that population to become decimated itself from its discovery. So you had this exploration of Antarctica being driven by the fur seal trade, by markets in Canton, in China, in Europe, in New York. But as I mentioned, those populations of fur seals became depleted very quickly. So it just didn't become very viable once a population was decreased so heavily. So you had a closure of the sealing industry, and it was after that a lot of legislation came in to protect the seals. So some of the earliest legislation was within the Falkland Islands, I believe, which had a complete ban on fur seal hunting. And then after that, you had in the 1970s a conference held in London. And essentially you had the Convention for the Conservation of Antarctic Seals. That was created, that was signed, and that banned the hunting of fur seals, elephant seals, and Ross seals, which is a very, very rare seal. And it provided quotas to catch the ice seals. So Weddell seals, crab eater seals, leopard seals, there were quotas to catch those. But I mean, really, there wasn't any sealing since the 1950s. And the only sort of seal hunting you really had was for dog food. So scientists were still killing seals after the 1950s to feed the dogs, which were used in early Antarctic exploration and research. but the removal of dogs occurred in 1994 because there was worries that a distemper virus could be spread from the dogs to the seals. So really since 1994, seals have virtually been, fully protected. They're not hunted anymore. And it was around the 1970s, 1990s that we started to get, modern comprehensive studies of seals going on. That's the kind of journey.
You're a researcher who tracks seals and goes to some of the most extreme places on Earth to do this sort of thing. But that's not all the things you're doing. You're also looking at ways to make polar science more accessible. You're very active as a science communicator and trying to get young people involved in this sort of in these ideas, in the way that you were inspired by Frozen Planet and other places. Just tell us a bit about the work you're doing on that front. Your Polar Impact Project. What does that aim to do?
Polar Impact, also known as the Minorities and Polar Research Network, is all about highlighting, supporting and connecting minorities, indigenous people, people of colour, from within the polar research community, and really just sharing who they are, what they do, and try and change the traditional sepia-toned images of polar explorer and try to give this fuller, richer picture to show that it's been this field which is in some ways always been quite diverse, quite global, not just recently, but also historically, and at the same time also support ethnic and racial minorities who are currently within the polar research field.
And so how do you do that? Well, what kind of events or what kinds of things are you trying to do on that front?
We do a whole variety of things. So we try to provide opportunities for people from underrepresented groups to gain polar experience. And one of those ways one of the ways in which I've done that is I hosted a citizen science project where I got funding from the British Antarctic Survey to host 12 students from underrepresented or disadvantaged backgrounds to come along and work with me in the British Antarctic Survey, where I taught them and trained them in how to use satellite imagery to monitor polar wildlife, penguins and seals, while at the same time also gaining some data by having them map the sea ice habitats and the seals within my satellite images. And that was a really amazing week. And I also provided them opportunities to meet lots of amazing senior polar scientists over coffees and so on. So I taught these students how to go about studying polar wildlife, and it provided them something that's a real privilege and is something that's very difficult to obtain, which is the privilege of being able to make a connection and study polar wildlife, which typically has only been restricted to people who go down to the poles. But looking at these satellite images, they were looking at colonies that no one else had ever laid eyes upon, and they were the first people to see that seal, to see that pup, to see
that's
that
amazing
colony. Yeah, and that was really amazing.
And were they were contributing to the conservation work there, were they?
Yeah, so they were contributing to a research project that's with the University of Cambridge, the British Antarctic Survey, WWF. So, these big towering names within the world of polar conservation, they were all significantly contributing to that research. And with their help, even after lockdown, I sort of had this little army of trained up volunteers. We continued doing research throughout lockdown, and we've built one of the first very high resolution sea ice habitat data sets for Antarctic seals from that. And they were, there are all these young sort of students who had no experience of polar research prior to this, but not only did they get trained up and in sort of the state-of-the-art techniques that gave them a avenue into polar research and conservation, even though for a lot of them they perhaps don't have the means or the capacity to have lots of exotic field works and exotic locations or the polar regions, but they were trained in high-impact conservation. They were trained in techniques that would enable them to have that would enable them to potentially conduct high-impact research with regards to polar conservation, and the proof of the pudding for that came on the final day. So on the final day of this week-long citizen science project, I had to go to Barcelona to present at a conference, and my supervisor, Peter Fretwell, very kindly took over and watched the students for me and helped them out. And because my supervisor was, you know, away from his office in a different environment, he began to just, I think perhaps maybe out of a bit of boredom or out of interest, he began to look at some satellite imagery in just some different random locations. And he ended up discovering these brand new emperor penguin colonies. So not only did my students get trained up in the skills to monitor polar wildlife, they were there when this big discovery was made. And I think, you know, very quickly, my supervisor wrote that up into a paper and submitted it to Nature and so on. And then it came out and it was this big news story. And there were so many phone calls going off to my supervisor. And yeah, my students had that full experience. And I was quite jealous that they were in the room when a brand new emperor penguin colony was discovered, I have to say.
I need to take a deep breath here because you've just listed so many things that I can't believe one person can do all of these things in a normal amount of time. So you're doing a PhD and you're researching for a documentary series, and you're doing about seven different projects to bring underrepresented groups to Antarctica virtually and through science. And so I mean, I find that incredible that you're doing all those things. So, you know, so thanks a lot for your time right now. I feel like I'm taking away from one of these really important projects, to be honest. But can you tell me, just in the moments we have left, you mentioned just now explorers of color and in the past century and even now. The history of Antarctica, as we've said so many times in this podcast, and as anyone who's expressed any interest in it knows, is very white. The history is very white, and the history is very male. We've talked a lot in this series about how women started to get opportunities to explore and then, you know, start to get towards an equal footing with men in the past 50 or so years. And it's not seen as a strange thing at all. And it should never be that the women are on the continent now being researchers and scientists and engineers and all sorts of other things. Is there still a sort of an issue in terms of people from non-white backgrounds in Antarctica?
So what I would say is that when it comes to polar research, I think one of the issues is in terms of just the image of who a polar researcher is. And as you've mentioned, it's often, you know, the go-to image is often a perhaps wealthy, white, bearded, sepia-toned image of a man who's been funded by the Queen to go on a, polar expedition. And that, you know, certainly isn't the case. Now we have a whole variety of people across the globe conducting polar research, and even within nations, there's a, you know, much wider cross-section of society involved in polar research, but there's still definitely an issue of that image. And I think for many people, for many children in particular, from a very young age, I think your beliefs of who you can be and what you can be driven by simply what you see, and in particular what you don't see. So if you don't see women polar explorers, if you don't see polar explorers of color, it's really easy to just presume, well, that's not what I'm capable of, that's not what I can
that's
do,
that's not open to me. Yeah.
So one of the main reasons I set up Polar Impact is for the few ethnic and racial minorities who are currently involved in polar research, is to really provide support to them to ensure they're retained, because it's not a new story of having ethnic and racial minorities in polar research. They've always been involved, but there hasn't necessarily been that retention because there has been potential issues. So I hope to provide this network to support people and enable to, and you know, basically retain these individuals who will become future role models. And I think so many of the role models when it comes to polar researchers and people of color, unfortunately, at times it can be people who have left and then they've become role models, after their careers are finished, I suppose, where I want people who are sort of existing in the polar research environment who are people of colour, presently to be able to just exist within this field and flourish within this field to be able to become those future role models. And over lockdown, I've been giving talks at schools, and I think one very sad thing I've noticed is that if I give a talk at, say, an independent school, where the teacher might be someone who has friends like me who work on Frozen Planet 2, who have PhDs studying polar regions, who might have worked as tour guides on polar ships, when I'm talking to their classroom, to their children, those kids will often ask me, you know, what can I do to be like you? How do I become a polar explorer, a polar researcher, a SEAL scientist? Whereas if I give a talk to a school in, say, a state school in a bit more of a working class area, those children won't ask me, how can we become a polar explorer? They'll just be really excited to talk to me. And they're essentially saying, thank you for sharing this experience with us, because we'll never experience it. And the teachers too, not because of any fault of their own, but they too, you know, say stuff like, you know, thank you so much for sharing this. It must be amazing to be this person. And it's very, you know, they're much less likely to ask, how can we be you? Because I guess, yeah, for a lot of working class kids, being a polar scientist is a bit like an astronaut. You know, people do it, but not you.
Yeah.
I guess for other people, it's a viable thing because you know people who do it. So
I hope you do. I hope you're. I expect you're the kind of person who, even if you're not asked how to become a polar explorer, you'll tell them anyway, just in case.
I will.
Of course you will.
I'll tell them.
That's
all
your
the
one man.
Ways.
One man escapade. Let you go without asking you about your art installations, though. So, as well as all the other things we've talked about, as if that wasn't enough to be doing, you've been making art installations with SEAL sounds and grime music. Now, you'll have to forgive me. I'm not a grime aficionado, so you're gonna have to explain what it is first of all, and then just tell us about the project.
Yes. So, where do I even start? Okay.
Where do you start? That's a great question.
I know, where? Okay. So, grime music is a genre of music from East London created by the black community there. And it's influenced by a whole bunch of stuff like garage and rap and jungle. But it really, for me, it's something I grew up in my teen years. And a lot of grime music was made it was all made on computers and even on game consoles sometimes in youth clubs. So a lot of grime music has a very almost retro synthy, almost kind of like electronic sound to it, if I want to really generalize. So that's what I grew up with, hearing those sort of electronic-y noises, which I was a big fan of for my musical taste. And then, I began studying Antarctic seals, and I came across a video of an Antarctic seal making some noises. And for those of you who haven't heard what an Antarctic seal sounds like, it sounds like the lasers in a sci-fi 70s movie. It sounds like a spaceship laser. It's very it's very otherworldly. It's very weird. It's just some people tell me it sounds like the Doctor Who opening theme tune, but a whole host of descriptions. But it's just these otherworldly cosmic noises. And another thing I noticed is that not only do the seals make these really weird otherworldly sounds, but we also have a base in East Antarctica called Halley, which has a space weather radio station. So the radio waves that are related to the southern lights and are picked up by a very low frequency radio receiver, when you sonify those, it creates sounds that essentially sound just like the Antarctic seals. So I thought, oh, that's cool. The southern lights.
It's all coming together.
Yeah, it's all coming together. So I'm like, oh, seals, space, they sound the same. This is great. And around this time, I was sort of giving this is during the first year of my PhD, and I was invited to give a talk alongside some very important, impressive people from the departments of the European Space Agency and these other amazing organizations and companies. And I thought,
I like where this is going.
I thought I'm the only student, and I was very worried nobody would be listening to my talk. So to get around that, I created a little pop quiz where it's like, here's some sounds. Is it seals? Is it space? By the way, my PhD is seals from space. That was the idea. So yeah, I went ahead with this pop quiz, which is great. And I use it as a way to also get rid of my anxiety before any talks. It works brilliantly. I gave the quiz, and someone came up to me from the Iron Tring Institute who makes techno music on the side. He was like, hey, let's make techno music. And I said, let's do grime instead. And then suddenly this whole project just grew out of it. And we're looking to include VR with other members from the Iron Tring Institute. And it's just, it's just snowballed into this very, very crazy thing. And when I was down in Antarctica, actually, I was trying my best to collect audio recordings of the seals, as well as all my scientific measurements of the seals using my thermal and my field spectrometer sensors. But yeah, sorry, I've gone on a really weird tangent.
Have you got a DJ name?
I don't. I mean, I do need a grime name. My friend Jules, he's the man behind the decks on all of this. He has a very fancy studio, but I mean, I guess I sometimes I
go on, go on. It was going to come out. Go on.
Well, this is not my name, but I do sometimes. There is a weird demo proof of concept album out there by an artist called Sealzy, which is Seal plus Stormzy, and yeah, it's all very, very uncool.
Even I know that Stormzy is a very famous grime artist. Even I know that.
Sealzy.
I'm hoping that when we edit this, that right now people will be listening to a bit of this Sealzy music. Why does Antarctica matter to you?
Antarctica and the polar oceans, it drives life as we know it today, society as we know it today, all the fisheries across the world, they're driven by, you know, the nutrients exported from the Southern Ocean, the currents that transport heat and nutrients. All of this is driving the world as we know it today. It impacts everyone globally. The polar regions are the regions which are changing the most rapidly. They are some of the most sensitive regions, and they all have some of the most largest impacts across the globe. So Antarctica can't not matter. It drives everything.
Thank you for listening. A Voyage to Antarctica is brought to you by the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust. To find out more about our guests, including photos and videos, head to our website at www.ukaht.org. Or follow our Facebook, Twitter and Instagram pages. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to follow us and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. The UK Antarctic Heritage Trust is the charity championing the public understanding of and engagement with Antarctica. This podcast is part of the Trust's Antarctica Insight programme, celebrating and reflecting on the past 201 years of human endeavour across this fascinating continent. The Antarctica Insight programme is supported by the Arts Council England, the Garfield Weston Foundation, and the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office. A Voyage to Antarctica was presented by me, Alok Jha, and produced by Jessica Norman. Ben Hewis is digital producer, and the music and sound design is by Alec Hughes.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.